From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm sorry to hear that Ms. Myers has decided to remove her name from consideration. I think that this is a sad episode in the history of Washington, D.C., which has a lot of sad episodes.
Harriet Myers withdraws her nomination to be a Supreme Court justice. We'll host a debate between Ralph Neese, People for the American Way, and Mekan Darahim, former chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Then a new report on the oil for food program in Iraq implicates more than 2,000 companies. We'll speak with the former head of the program, Dennis Halliday.
After thousands of pages, the Volcker Inquiry Report finally looks at the United Nations member states and their manipulation, profit-making, and corruption of the Oil for Food program, which was originally designed to lessen the killing of the Iraqi people under UN sanctions.
And a prominent Iraqi-American doctor is sentenced to 22 years in prison for violating Iraqi sanctions.
The government will impose monetary fines on individuals or companies that violate the sanctions against the sanctioned country. But in the case of Dr. Dafir, criminal charges were filed, and that is very unusual. It's also very unusual to have a defendant in a white-collar crime case be denied any measure of reasonable bail.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, is expected to be charged today with making false statements to the grand jury investigating the outing of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal says President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, was informed Thursday evening he may not be charged today, but will remain under investigation. The Times says that independent counsel Patrick Fitzgerald was likely to extend the term of the federal grand jury beyond its scheduled expiration. One of the most prominent Republican fundraisers for President Bush in Ohio has been charged with illegally funneling money to Bush's reelection campaign. A federal grand jury also charged businessman Thomas Noe with making false statements to the Federal Election Commission. The three counts lodged against Noe each carry a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison and a fine. The indictment alleges Noe laundered $45,000 in contributions by recruiting and providing money to 24 friends and associates who made contributions in their names so Noe could avoid the individual campaign contribution limit of $2,000. Another state grand jury in Ohio is investigating Noe's $50 million investment in rare coins on behalf of Ohio's Bureau of Workers' Compensation. The Ohio Attorney General has accused Noe of stealing at least $4 million of it. There continue to be serious allegations of vote fraud in Ohio in the 2004 elections. Iraq's political parties have finalized their coalition list for the December 15th elections. The lists were due today. Three of Iraq's most powerful Shiite Muslim religious parties have formed a reshuffled alliance. In a surprising move, the political groups of the young cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have joined with the two parties that control Iraq's transitional government. Dawa, led by Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari, and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Sadr has historically resisted participating in a political process he's denounced as a U.S.-created sham, and his forces reportedly joined on the condition the coalition oppose a normalization of relations with Israel. Meanwhile, the two main Kurdish parties have formed their own coalition, while Sunni Arab leaders formed an alliance. This comes days after fierce Sunni opposition narrowly failed to veto the new U.S.-backed constitution in a referendum. The new group, called Iraqi Accord Front, called on all Iraqis to participate in elections and not to boycott. But what has gotten little attention is the fact the group says it opposes the U.S. occupation. A prominent Sunni leader, Hussein al-Faluji, told Reuters, quote, "Our political program will focus more on getting the Americans out of Iraq. Our message to the American administration is clear. Get out of Iraq or set a timetable for withdrawal or the resistance will keep slaughtering your soldiers until Judgment Day," unquote. Time magazine is reporting the target of this Monday's attack against Baghdad's Palestine Hotel may not have been foreign journalists, as was originally believed. The magazine, citing sources inside the Iraqi resistance, says the real target was a private security firm based in the hotel. The well-coordinated attack involving truck bombs killed at least 6 people. Times says resistance fighters believe the targeted security firm is actually a Western or Israeli government intelligence agency. As the U.S. military death toll in Iraq surpassed 2,000 dead this week, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution editorial cartoonist Mike Lukovich marked the tragic milestone by handwriting the name of each one in his Wednesday editorial cartoon. Together, their names spell out the question, why? The Pulitzer Prize-winning Lukovich told editor and publisher, quote, "I was trying to think of a way to make the point that this whole war is such a waste, but I also wanted to honor the troops I believe our government wrongly sent to Iraq." Lukovich says he spent 12 or 13 hours this past weekend writing in most of the names, roughly in the order of when the soldiers died. The paper's publisher and various editors were also involved in the effort. When it looked like the names might not be readable, the editors gave permission for the cartoon to be published much larger than Lukovich's drawings usually appear in the Journal Constitution. MTV has compiled some new statistics on the 2,000 U.S. troops killed in Iraq. Nearly a third were between the ages of 20 and 22, with the highest fatality rate, about 12%, being among 21-year-olds. Nearly 70% of U.S. casualties are under the age of 30. 40% left behind spouses. 30% were survived by children. Lawyers for Brooklyn-born Jose Padilla, the man accused of plotting to set off a dirty bomb inside the United States, have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to limit the government's power to hold him and other U.S. terror suspects indefinitely and without charge. Padilla, who's still a U.S. citizen, has been held for over 3 years in solitary confinement on a Navy brig. No charges have ever been filed against him, and he's never appeared before a judge. Justices refused on a 5-4 vote last year to review Padilla's rights, ruling he contested his detention in the wrong court. One of Padilla's attorneys, Donna Newman, said the new case asks when and for how long the government can jail people in military prisons. She says the Bush administration's position, quote, is not only can we do it forever? In my opinion, she says, that's very problematic and something we should all be very concerned about, unquote. Justices will not decide until late this year whether to hear Padilla's appeal. Meanwhile, a federal judge this week upheld the conviction of human rights attorney Lynn Stewart on terror-related charges. In their latest appeal, Stewart's lawyers allege a juror on the case feared for her life and had been coerced into voting to convict. In a separate opinion upholding the convictions of Lynn Stewart and two co-defendants, the judge also ruled separately that they were not protected by the First Amendment. Stewart was convicted on February 10th of conspiracy and providing material support to terrorism by releasing a statement by her imprisoned client, Sheikh Omar Abdurrahman. Lynn Stewart is scheduled to be sentenced on December 22nd. Cuban President Fidel Castro has denied his government had accepted U.S. aid following the devastation of Hurricane Wilma. Castro appeared on national television, accused the U.S. and Europe of failing to provide enough help to Guatemala as it recovered from devastating mudslides in Hurricane Stan earlier this month. The U.S. State Department had announced this week Cuba had accepted U.S. disaster aid. But in his address Thursday, Castro said it wasn't true, and he chastised the offer of $50,000.
Dollars save no one. They arrive at a bank. Doctors carrying their backpacks who arrive quickly and go in any way they can at a time, they save lives. 50,000. They're sending 50,000. I want to laugh. It's shameful. They walk around talking about human rights, defending mercenaries of the empire, and they don't send doctors for one simple reason. Some would say it's because they're egotistical, because they're arrogant, because they don't feel any pain for what's going on in the third world. There are all of those things, but they don't send doctors because they don't have doctors.
Pero es que no tienen médico.
During Hurricane Katrina, President Castro offered to send 1,500 doctors equipped with disaster response backpacks, but the U.S. did not accept the offer. This news from the Netherlands. A fire in a detention center for suspected drug smugglers and undocumented immigrants at Amsterdam's airport has killed at least 11 people. It took the fire squads 3 hours to bring the fire under control at the detention center that holds some 350 prisoners. One detainee told a Dutch radio station the fire broke out in one of the cells and that when the prisoners cried out in alarm, they were not taken seriously. The State Department announced this week, starting next October, all U.S. passports will be implanted with computer chips. Sweeping new regulations say passports issued after that time will have radio frequency ID chips that can transmit personal information, including the name, nationality, sex, date of birth, place of birth, and digitized photograph of the passport holder. Eventually, the government may add digitized data such as fingerprints or iris scans. Out of the more than 2,000 comments on the plan that were received by the State Department this year, more than 98% were negative. And Rosa Parks may become the first woman to officially lie in state at the Capitol Rotunda under resolutions prepared Thursday by lawmakers. She died Monday in Detroit at the age of 92. The resolution calls for Parks to lie in honor in the rotunda on Sunday and Monday, quote, so that the citizens of the United States may pay their last respects to this great American. Historically, only presidents, members of Congress, and military commanders have been permitted to lie in the rotunda. Parks would be the first woman and the second African American to receive the accolade. The Capitol event was one of several planned to honor the civil rights pioneer. From Monday night until Wednesday morning, Rosa Parks will lie in repose at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. Her funeral will be Wednesday at Greater Grace Temple Church in Detroit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Harriet Myers withdrew her nomination Thursday to be a Supreme Court justice. She'd come under intense criticism from the Christian right, many Republican senators as well. But it was Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid who lamented the decision.
Ms. Myers didn't satisfy those who want to pack the Supreme Court with rigid ideologies. The only voices heard in this process were the far right. She wasn't even given a chance to speak for herself before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
In a letter to the White House, Myers said she was concerned the confirmation process, quote, would create a burden for the White House and our staff that is not best in the interest of the country, she said. Myers went on to write she needed to withdraw because senators were seeking White House records that could not be released because of executive privilege. This is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter.
I'm sorry to hear that Ms. Myers has decided to remove her name from consideration. I think that this is a sad episode in the history of Washington, D.C., which has a lot of sad episodes. But the way Harriet Myers has been treated is really disgraceful.
That was Arlen Specter. Harriet Myers and President Bush have been close friends for nearly two decades. Myers began working for Bush when he was running for governor of Texas in 1994. She remains White House counsel. Myers would have become the third woman to have served on the Supreme Court. President Bush said he reluctantly accepted the decision of his White House counsel and longtime ally and would move quickly to fill the vacancy on the court created by the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. We're joined now in Washington, D.C. by Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way Foundation. We're also joined by attorney Macon Doerheim. From 2000 to 2003, he was chief counsel and staff director to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. He also is a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division in the Department of Justice. On the line from Madison, Wisconsin, is John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, associate editor for the Madison Capital Times. We're going to begin with Ralph Neese, People for the American Way. Ralph, can you talk about Harriet Myers' decision to withdraw as a nominee to be Supreme Court Justice?
Amy, I've been working on Supreme Court nominations since 1975 when I was Republican chief counsel to Senator Edward W. Brooke. I've never seen anything like this. This has been an astonishing spectacle. The president was attacked from within his own base, and he was pounded day after day, as was Harriet Myers. He basically surrendered. It was an abject, total capitulation to the right-wing special interest groups. They want someone on the court that is going to be a guaranteed vote to overturn scores of Supreme Court precedents going back 70 years, affecting privacy, equal opportunity, the environment, religious liberty, reproductive health, reproductive rights. Harriet Myers, to them, was someone they didn't know. They didn't know where she was on a judicial philosophy. They demanded, they dictated that the president withdraw this nomination. I'm not sure this has ever happened before. It's a great sign. A very convincing sign of how powerful the radical right is, that they can force a president of the United States to withdraw his own nominee before the hearings even begin, before she has a chance to defend herself.
John Nichols in Madison, Wisconsin, your response to the timing of the nomination.
Okay. Come down underneath. Is that what you mean?
Timing, rather, of the withdrawal.
The timing of the withdrawal is incredibly significant. And I agree completely with Ralph Neese that what undermined Harriet Myers was the attack from the right. The withdrawal was a complete political act. It was done not by Harriet Myers. She did not reluctantly withdraw, and the president did not reluctantly accept the withdrawal. What happened was, early this week, the White House political office began calling around to right-wing groups saying, you know, how can we most conveniently, most effectively withdraw this nomination? They began laying the base well before it actually occurred. And they were doing it with an eye toward doing the withdrawal on the day before, if they could most effectively do it on the day before the indictments would come down in the Patrick Fitzgerald investigation of Libby and Rove. And their purpose for that was obvious. You withdraw this nomination, you get a day of national attention to the withdrawal. Here we are talking about it. And that tamps down some of the speculation about who's going to be indicted, as well as some of the speculation about how close it will go to the president and vice president. At the same time, once the indictments come, then we forget about Harriet Myers. As Trent Lott said yesterday afternoon, who's going to remember Harriet Myers next week? So this is a very political act done by an administration which, intriguingly enough, is often credited for being loyal. The president is often said to be excessively loyal. Well, here he had really someone who's said to be one of his very best friends. and he threw her to the side with the sole purpose of making sure that he could be in the right political position when some very embarrassing indictments came down.
I want to go to Macon Darheim again. Worked with Justice Priscilla Owen, is a partner at Brownstein, Hyatt, and Farber, Chief Counsel and Staff Director to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, 2000-2003. Can you talk about Harriet Myers and your position on her nomination and then your response to her withdrawal?
Amy, yes. I've worked with a number of what some called controversial nominees and was there during some of the filibuster debates and worked closely with Ralph. We've been friends and collegial adversaries, and I love some of the spin in Washington. I think Harriet Myers was looking forward to the committee, and Republicans, not a single one, some have expressed reservation, but nobody opposed her. And I think what began happening is some of the pro-abortion groups started getting uncomfortable with some of her positions that was being expressed, some of the memos, some of the comments she had made. And you noticed a lot of Democrats beginning to sound the signs of alarm. You had Senator Schumer, Senator Boxer, who said very negative things and raised a lot of concerns about her qualifications. And I think what happened was that she realized that she was going to get to an impasse on the committee. And I think the Democrats waited, but they were very concerned that she might get on the court, and there was a lot of pressure. And I think my friend Ralph here is sighing a little bit of relief this morning, as are some other Democrats, that she was withdrawn and are saying that it was because of the right-wing groups. And I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think it was just the fact that they noticed that the Democrats were going to be asking her questions she couldn't answer and ask for documents that she couldn't give, and ultimately it was going to be an impasse, which was going to cause her to cross the line between her loyalty to the president and her duties of candor before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Macon Darheim, a former chief counsel and staff director to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, also Ralph Neese in Washington of People for the American Way, as well John Nichols on the phone. We'll be back with them in a minute. We'll be right back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we broadcast on over 380 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM stations, as well as college radio stations, and also on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We are podcasting at democracynow.org as well, as we talk about the withdrawal of the nominee Harriet Myers, the White House counsel as Supreme Court Justice. Our guest, Ralph Nies, president of People for the American Way. Macon Darheim, a partner with Brownstein, Hyatt and Farber, formerly chief counsel and staff director to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. Also on the line with us, we're joined by John Nichols of Madison, Wisconsin, of The Nation and Madison Capital Times. Macon Darheim, can you talk about the response of the Christian right, the conservatives who opposed Harriet Myers, and their response to your support for her?
Well, I think that there were some concerns raised, not so much because of concerns about her record, but just lack of verification of where she stood on some of the principled views of, is she a strict constructionist, and does she view the Constitution and the fundamental principles within the Constitution interpreting cases, or does she view it as an evolving document? And I think the important thing now is to really step back, just like Senator Schumer said yesterday, and start fresh, look to the majority of the population, not some of the folks all the way either to the right or to the left, and start fresh on an important nomination to our nation's Supreme Court, and put somebody up there who will strictly interpret the Constitution instead of making law and nullifying property rights, ruling that child pornography laws are unconstitutional and Congress didn't have the power, or, you know, issues like the Pledge of Allegiance, and putting up there folks who are honorable, who have the qualifications, like a John Roberts, that can strictly interpret the Constitution and go on the court. And I think, as a country, that's what we should be focusing on and not looking back to the Myers nomination.
Ralph Nies of People for the American Way. On the issue of this being a victory for conservative activists, if that's what President Bush was responding to, even if liberals and Democrats, progressives, were opposed to her nomination, then what do you expect to happen next? Who do you expect to be nominated next?
It's important, number one, to point out the progressive community and the Democrats had not taken a position on Harriet Myers. The position was that she should have hearings and have an opportunity to tell the American people in the Senate what her judicial philosophy is and address the issues of judicial independence. The tipping point probably came 2 days ago when the Washington Post put out a story that had her speeches from the 1990s where she talked about self-determination for a woman and her choice regarding reproductive rights. The right wing went crazy and I think absolutely demanded that she withdraw immediately. In terms of what it means, I think that the right has dictated the withdrawal of Harriet Myers. I think they're going to dictate who the president nominates now. They've made it clear it has to be someone like Robert Bork, Antonin Scalia, or Clarence Thomas. They will accept no one less than that. As one right-wing senator said 2 days ago, we need tangible, objective evidence of where she's going to be on these key constitutional issues.
Macon Darheim, chief counsel, former staff director for the Senate Judiciary Committee. Who are some of the possibilities that you see next? And can you talk about, in particular, Judge Priscilla Owen, someone you know and have worked with?
Sure. I worked on her confirmation, her elevation from the state Supreme Court in Texas to the Fifth Circuit through some of the efforts to filibuster her. She is an extremely qualified jurist, experienced lawyer, a remarkable woman who has served on the Texas Supreme Court and now for a little over a year on the Fifth Circuit. She would make an excellent nominee. She is one who some folks would say that her views on abortion are suspect because she had a ruling on parental notification. And I think the president and the Republicans in the Senate would welcome a national debate on parental notification, whether or not my teenage daughter wants to get an abortion, whether I should just get notice, not even consent. And I think that's an issue that is up for debate. But I think some of the others who are good candidates, you hear Judge Maura Corrigan, you've got, I think, another excellent nominee in the likes of John Roberts would be a Carolyn Kuhl, who was nominated before and then ended up withdrawing after some efforts to filibuster her. An excellent nominee that nobody has really talked about would be the Solicitor General of the United States, Paul Clement, who is a brilliant lawyer, has argued over 20 cases before the Supreme Court, of the same ilk of, you know, Justice Douglas. He is, I think, 39 years old, and I hope people begin considering her somebody who got unanimously confirmed to the Solicitor General's job, and many call the 10th Justice of the Supreme Court. It'll be nice to make him the 9th Justice of the Supreme Court.
Ralph Neese of People for the American Way, your response on Judge Priscilla Owen and the other people that Macon Darheim just mentioned and others you are looking at.
There's no question that if the president nominated Priscilla Owen, it would precipitate an extraordinary confrontation. And I think that there would be a majority of the Senate that would oppose her because she not only has a right-wing judicial philosophy in the mold of Clarence Thomas and Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia, but she has been a judicial activist, allowing her ideology to trump her responsibilities as a jurist on the circuit court. In fact, Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States, served with Priscilla Owen on the Texas Supreme Court on 11 different occasions, not once. Everyone remembers Alberto Gonzalez saying, with respect to the parental notification case, that she was remaking the Texas law and was engaged in an unconscionable act of judicial activism. Well, in 10 other occasions, he accused her also of being a judicial activist. That's why the Senate Democrats filibustered. It wasn't just because of her right-wing judicial philosophy, but she allowed that philosophy to overrule her judgment and her duties as a jurist. So that would precipitate, definitely. I don't think there would have to be a filibuster because I think enough Republicans would join the Democrats because of her views on reproductive rights and privacy, civil rights, consumer issues. She always rules for big business and certainly on the environmental protections. This would be one of the four or five most controversial nominees.
We're talking to Ralph Neese and of People for the American Way and Macon Darheim, who is formerly staff head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Ralph Neese, what about other people who have been put forward, like Janice Brown and others that Macon Darheim mentioned? Ralph Neese.
With respect to Janice Rogers Brown, I think along with Priscilla Owen and Michael Luttig and Edith Jones and Emily Garza and others, among the most controversial, Janice Rogers Brown is probably more candid than just about any nominee that's come before the Senate. She basically thinks that everything that's happened since the 1930s in the Supreme Court has been erroneously decided. The right likes to talk about the Constitution being an exile and that they have to bring back that Constitution and redefine key constitutional provisions with respect to the Spending Clause, the Commerce Clause, the 14th Amendment. She is one of the most fierce, strongest advocates of the Constitution in exile. And again, like Priscilla Owen, would definitely engender a fierce fight on the Senate floor and in the committee. So I certainly hope that the president tries to come up with a mainstream conservative, someone in the mold of Sandra Day O'Connor, obviously someone who's not going to agree with progressives all the time, but is someone of moderation, independent judgment, someone who could bring the country together, someone, and this is such a a tumultuous time internationally and domestically. I think the country is begging for a situation where there's a bipartisan consensus. The president reaches across the aisle and says, what's best for the country? Who can we come up with that's a bipartisan choice that will command the respect and the votes of the Senate, 70 or 80 at least, not necessarily everybody on the right, but also command the respect of the entire country. I hope that's what happened, but in light of the last 24 hours, I doubt it. He capitulated, the president, he capitulated big time, as Dick Cheney would say, and I think he's now found out that he really is a captive of the right wing.
Well, suspense is also high right now, nation abuzz with speculations about who might be indicted today in the CIA leak case. The grand jury in the case is expected to meet this morning. Special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald expected to announce the results of the 22-month investigation around midday. Fitzgerald's investigating whether Plame's identity was leaked as part of an effort to discredit her husband, Joseph Wilson, the former ambassador who'd accused the Bush administration of twisting the intelligence it used to justify the invasion of Iraq. The spotlight is now on Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, and Karl Rove, President Bush's senior advisor and deputy chief of staff. Rumors are running wild that Libby's expected to be indicted today, charged with making false statements to the grand jury. And the New York Times reports people officially briefed about the case said Rove will not be charged but will remain under investigation. This could mean Fitzgerald likely extend the term of the federal grand jury beyond today's scheduled expiration date. John Nichols, what about the whole CIA leak case, the possibility of these indictments?
Well, it is likely that something major will happen today. As you mentioned, Amy, the New York Times has mentioned the theory, and it is just that, or speculation, that Libby will be indicted, that the Rove investigation will be held open. We know that on Wednesday afternoon, probably the most significant development occurred, and that's when Patrick Fitzgerald met with the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The chief judge is the only person with the power to extend the life of the grand jury. And my suspicion is, although we'll find this out as the day goes on, that Patrick Fitzgerald has said that things that he has discovered in the last few days, as well as some aspects of the case that have not been tied up yet, make it a requirement, a necessity, that the grand jury should continue, that the investigation should continue. On a sidelight to that, we know that Patrick Fitzgerald has just leased substantially larger offices in the vicinity of the offices he's been working out of. So I think what we're looking at here is not the end of an investigation into what some folks call Plamegate, but what is really an extension of the dialogue, the discourse, the debate about whether this country was led into war on the basis of false information or doctored intelligence. That investigation will continue, and that's a very good thing, because an investigation that was to stop with the indictment of Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, would leave open vast questions, and the largest of those questions being who in their right mind believes that the vice president's chief of staff was involved in this and the vice president wasn't.
John Nichols, you are the author of the book, Dick, the Man Who Is President, about Vice President Dick Cheney. What about his role in all of this?
Look, I've been writing about Dick Cheney for a very long time and following him in many different settings. And there's one sort of basic template we can look at with Cheney, and that is everyone says he is a man who, A, wants to have all of the information about whatever's going on, B, wants to be at the center of strategic decision-making, C, is obsessed with what appears in the media with regard to him and the administration, and D, is very vindictive. You put those pieces together, and it is impossible to imagine that he was not in some way engaged with the discussions about how to punish former Ambassador Joe Wilson for revealing that the administration's case for war, a case that Cheney put far more aggressively than George Bush, had been based on a misread, an intentional misread, of intelligence. Bottom line, Dick Cheney is certainly a part of this investigation. We don't know how far it would go. And frankly, we don't know just exactly how courageous Patrick Fitzgerald is, because any serious investigation of Scooter Libby and the whole case has to take you to Cheney's doorstep. I'm not the only one saying that. A year ago, when I interviewed Joe Wilson for my book, more than a year ago, We talked specifically about this. And at that time, Joe Wilson said, look, if you want to get to the people who are most likely to have had the access to the information, the motivation to do something with it, and the ability to move through back channels to communicate about it, you have to go to Cheney's office. And I asked him, do you have to go to Cheney? And he said, he's got to be at the center of it.
Finally, Ralph Neese, how do you think these indictments, or not, we'll see in just a little while today, at the time of this broadcast, they haven't come down, will affect, do you think they'll affect the Supreme Court justice nomination?
Well, I do think it was no coincidence that the president decided yesterday on the withdrawal, knowing that there was going to be a big news day today or sometime soon, so that would end the Harriet Meyer story. And my guess is there'll be a Supreme Court nomination pretty quickly to try to mitigate the damage done by what's going to happen today or early next week. This is all really an accumulation of extraordinary situations and circumstances, both with respect to Iraq and the war on terror and Katrina and rising gas prices, delay, Frist, Abramoff, you name it. This is all coming together to put the White House and the president at a tremendous disadvantage. His presidency suffered a blow yesterday. The American people thought, if nothing else, he was resolute and loyal to those who were loyal to him. Well, obviously, he abandoned Harriet Myers yesterday, and he doesn't appear so resolute. And I think the indictments today or coming soon, if they do happen, are going to further weaken the presidency. This does not augur well for the next 2 or 3 years, and I think it's going to affect him with respect to Capitol Hill and with respect to his programs. I hope he starts reaching out and tries to govern in a bipartisan manner and try to appeal to 70% or 80% of the American people rather than the 20% or 30% that constitute the radical right represented by Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and the others on the right. I hope he learns from these recent examples and governs as he should.
Well, Ralph Neese, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us, President for People for the American Way. Malcolm Dewar-Heem, also for being with us. Again, has worked with Justice Priscilla Owen, former staff head of the Senate Judiciary Committee from 2000 to 2003, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General, Antitrust Division of the Justice Department. And John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation, also with Madison Capital Times and author of the book, Dick. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a lot of talk about 2,000 U.S. servicemen and women dead. What about the Iraqis? We'll talk about the casualties of them as well, and also the casualties, Iraqi casualties as well. Also, the new report that's come out for the Oil for Food program, finding more than 2,000 companies benefited. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, the independent inquiry investigating the UN Oil for Food program in Iraq issued its fifth and final report. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan created the inquiry in April 2004. Under Oil for Food, the Iraqi government was allowed to sell oil for funds it could use to purchase humanitarian goods. Devastated by the crippling U.S.-led sanctions, most Iraqis depended on the program for survival. It ran from 1996 to 2003. The inquiry found the Saddam Hussein regime collected $1.8 billion in kickbacks and surcharges from oil sales to over 2,000 companies. The companies include major global firms such as Daimler Chrysler, Siemens, Volvo. It also says oil sales were used to influence beneficiaries to express public opposition to the U.S.-led sanctions on Iraq. The $1.8 billion figure amounts to less than 3% of the $64 billion program, but it has received a great deal of attention from U.N. critics in the mainstream media and both political parties. These critics say the kickbacks and surcharges show the U.N. is plagued by endemic corruption, has been negligent in dealing with the Hussein regime. The inquiry was headed by Paul Volcker, former chair of the Federal Reserve.
What I do want to emphasize is that the corruption of the program by Saddam and by many participants, and it was substantial, could not have been nearly so pervasive if there had been more disciplined management by the UN and its agencies. It is in that sense that this last report reinforces and underscores the need for fundamental and wide-ranging administrative reform that we emphasized in our report last month.
That was Independent Inquiry Committee head Paul Volcker speaking Thursday. While much of the focus has remained on the UN failure to monitor kickbacks and bribes, little attention has been paid to another of the investigation's main conclusions. The Volcker inquiry found Hussein was able to make almost $11 billion off of selling oil smuggled through Jordan and Turkey. A Senate investigation in May found the Bush administration was made aware of the smuggling, but did nothing to stop it. Jordan and Turkey are key U.S. allies in the Middle East. 52% of the kickbacks collected by the Saddam Hussein regime came through U.S. oil purchases. The Senate investigation's report said, quote, the United States was not only aware of Iraqi oil sales, which violated U.N. sanctions and provided the bulk of the illicit money Saddam Hussein obtained from circumventing U.N. sanctions. On occasion, the United States actually facilitated the illicit oil sales. Again, that from the report. Well, joining us to talk about the Volcker Report is Dennis Halliday, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program, the oil humanitarian program in Iraq, former UN Assistant Secretary General. In 1998, he resigned his post in protest of the U.S.-led sanctions against Iraq, which he has since called genocidal. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
But before we get your response to the report, a lot is being said this week about 2,000 U.S. servicemen and women dead in Iraq, a terrible number of casualties. Mm-hmm. What about the number of Iraqis?
Mm. Well, you know, let me say first, I also feel the pain of American families who've lost young people. And the figures you gave show that many are 20, 21. They're just children, badly educated, not knowing what they're doing. Perhaps it's a tragic loss of life. But we mustn't forget there's probably over 100,000 Iraqi civilians killed by American troops in this invasion and occupation. And that is a huge tragedy, which somehow we forget about in this country. It reminds me very much of Vietnam. It wasn't 58,000 who died in Vietnam. It was perhaps 2 to 3 million. And the same mistake has been made in Washington and throughout this country.
And how do you know that figure?
Which figure?
100,000 Iraqis.
Well, this came out of Lancet, the well-known British medical journal. And the figures keep on being endorsed. But whether it's 30 or 50 or 100, it's much greater than 2,000. And we cannot forget that these are innocent civilians we're talking about. We're not talking about military casualties on the part of Iraq.
On the issue of the Oil for Food program, the kickbacks, who benefited, who didn't, your response to this latest and final report?
Well, for me, this is the most important part of the report. He's now wasted thousands of pages looking at the Secretariat and the Secretary General and one or two bad apples, to use Mr. Bush's term, within the Secretariat. Now we're looking at the big stuff, and we're looking at the member states of the Security Council, their control or lack of control of their companies, which sold to Iraq, and as you've just said, purchased oil from Iraq, including the United States, although perhaps indirectly, and the corruption and kickbacks and profit-making that came out of this process of Oil for Food, which in itself is a good program and did some very good work. But to see these countries and their corporate entities profiteering, of course, is very sad, very miserable view of life. But I think we have to underline that the $64 billion program was not actually diminished by this 1.8. This 1.8 is over and above those payments which were made properly and through the United Nations and dispersed, hopefully, properly, too.
And what about the issue of Jordan and Turkey, key U.S. allies?
That's right. This was a deal made clearly with Turkey, where Incirlik resides, when the Americans were using the airbase there to bomb Iraq under the no-fly zone bombing program. And Jordan is a very important member state, both for actually Iraq and the United States. And this sale of Baghdad through the north and through the Jordanian border was approved by the State Department. I mean, I've witnessed thousands of trucks myself crossing both of those borders, full knowledge what was going on. Only later I discovered the State Department had, in fact, approved this so-called, but it wasn't underhand, it was above board, we all knew about it. U.S. satellites monitored this traffic.
Well, I want to talk about someone who is being punished for breaking the sanctions and also get your response as well. Yeah. While the UN report on oil for food has been making headlines, there is another story in the news this week involving the Iraqi sanctions that's received little national attention. In Syracuse, New York, a prominent Iraqi-American doctor was sentenced to 22 years in prison Thursday for violating the Iraqi sanctions through his charity, Help the Needy. Oncologist Rafil Dafir was arrested 19 months ago in a dramatic fashion. More than 85 federal agents descended on his home. He was handcuffed in his driveway. Agents hauled dozens of books and records away. In August 2004, New York Governor George Pataki claimed Dafir was connected to, quote, money laundering efforts to help terrorist organizations. But terrorism charges against the doctor never materialized. Instead, supporters of the doctor say the Justice Department went hunting for possible charges against Dr. Dafir. Eventually, they filed 60 charges against him involving breaking the sanctions, tax evasion, and Medicare fraud. Earlier this year, a jury convicted him on 59 of the 60 charges, and we're joined as well by Barry Gowanter, executive director of the Central New York chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union, who's closely monitored the case and has publicly questioned whether Dr. Dafir received a fair trial. She joins us on the phone from Syracuse. Can you tell us what happened yesterday and about this case of Dr. Dafir?
Certainly, Amy. Good morning. The federal government has repeatedly tried to pitch this as a case with national security implications, but they never actually charged him with anything related to terrorism. Instead, this was really a case of white-collar crime. It was full of financial statements and details of financial transactions. But at the end of the trial, when it came to the sentencing phase, the government made allegations that Dr. Dafir had links to terrorist groups or supported factions in Iraq many years ago that were now fighting against the United States. And we feel that it's inappropriate to bring in allegations of terrorist links through the back door of sentencing.
How does this fit into the sanctions against Iraq in the 1990s?
Well, Dr. Dafir created a charity called Help the Needy, whose stated intent was to provide food and medicine and other supports to people suffering from the sanctions. The government's main core charge against him was that he violated a law called IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is how a president imposes economic sanctions against a sanctioned country. That law says that you cannot send money to a sanctioned country. And in order to send humanitarian aid, you have to be an approved charity and have approved shipments. The testimony in the trial suggested that Dr. Dafir did not go through those channels because he was concerned that any material that was sent into Iraq for the Oil for Food program would end up in Saddam's pockets. And he wanted the aid to get to people who were truly needy because he was very concerned about the suffering.
Dennis Halliday, do you know this case at all? Have you ever heard of Dr. Dafir?
No, strangely, I have not. I'm absolutely stunned by this information. I mean, it's an outrageous situation, particularly as we've just discussed the State Department breaching its own or the United Nations sanctions to the tune of $10 billion, allowing Saddam Hussein to export oil and import at the same time. And now we're prosecuting an American Iraqi. It's unbelievable.
And he is not the only one, is that right, Barry Gowanter, who has been sentenced in this case?
He is not the only one. There were five other defendants that were involved with the operation of the charity. And to be very clear, there were some problems in the way that the charity was operated. what raises for us questions is the idea that the government could have imposed fines for several of the charges and instead went forward with criminal sanctions and then piled on a total of 60 counts against Dr. DeFeer. Each one of the five defendants was forced to testify against him, including his wife, in exchange for getting probation or a recommendation for a reduced sentence.
Wait, including his wife?
Correct. There are additional charges against him, including the besides the IEPA violations. There was charges of money laundering, tax evasion, mail and wire fraud, but also Medicare fraud. His wife was the billing manager in his medical office. And in the course of the investigation, they found that he went overseas and started looking at his Medicare billing. And there's about a 15% difference in the Medicare billing that is very confusing. But when the doctor is out of the office and he is an oncologist, his office provides chemotherapy, they charge 15% less if a nurse practitioner administers the chemotherapy when the doctor is not in the office, and 15% more when he is in the office. And his wife was charged with conspiring with him to violate those Medicare rules.
How does this compare to what Voices in the Wilderness did in defiantly breaching the sanctions, believing that the people of Iraq needed humanitarian aid?
Well, that's what's really interesting about this. There are American companies that, throughout the sanctions, violated the sanctions, and American CEOs who made the decision to do so, and activist organizations like Voices in the Wilderness that is not identified as a Muslim organization. And yet those companies and that organization, the government imposed...
Voices in the Wilderness, of course, a humanitarian group founded by Kathy Kelly, who repeatedly went to Iraq.
Exactly. And we have some people from the Syracuse area that went with Voices in the Wilderness to Iraq. Those individuals and the organization Voices in the Wilderness never got criminal charges filed against them. Instead, the government imposed only fines. Our perception is that the only people that get criminal charges filed against them tend to be Muslims and Arabs. That raises questions about selective enforcement.
As we wrap up, Dennis Halliday, hearing about this case, the sentencing of Dr. DeFeer to 22 years in jail. He's already served. How long, Barry Gwanter?
2 years in jail, and that's...
How many years in jail?
2 years in jail.
2 years, now sentenced to 22 years in jail. In this last minute, looking at the final vocal report, looking at Turkey and Jordan, the U.S. corporations like Volvo and Daimler Chrysler, and putting Dr. DeFeer into this.
Well, the impression one gets is the U.S. government is going after the weak and those who can't defend themselves. Although in this case, there seems to be more than perhaps meets the eye. It's more than sanctions breaking, which, as you rightly said, Voices in the Wilderness has done. I think this report we have now, which is supposed to be the final report, actually raises questions, some of which may be answered by congressional committees, which are looking into some of the improprieties under the Bremer period and other occupation activities and diversion of monies to Halliburton and Halliburton ripping off the Pentagon, for example. Some of this will continue. Whether Volcker will continue, although he perhaps should, having raised questions and no answers, that remains to be seen.
Dennis Halliday, former assistant UN Secretary General and head of the UN Humanitarian Program of Iraq until he resigned his post in protest of U.S.-led sanctions, and Barry Gwanter, who heads the Central New York chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. That does it for today's broadcast. You can go to our website to see video photographs. If you're a radio listener, you can also get our podcast there at democracynow.org. We have our transcripts as well as headlines in Spanish in audio and transcript form. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, you can sign up for our daily headlines at our website at democracynow.org. Have a good weekend. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.